I'm Eric Decker, and this is the Jets Blog Podcast.
Welcome back to the Jets Blog Podcast. I am your host, Corey Griffin, and with me, as always, on the other line, it's Brian Bassett.
Corey, hello. How are you doing on this fine April day?
I'm doing just fine. It's not as cold as it was yesterday, and I have our special guest. You know, I know we normally sometimes, you know, we interview our friends, we have our friends on the show, but I'd like to call just physically close and personal friend right now. Josh Norris is literally sitting within 3 inches of me.
I have a written portion of my contract that says all my interviews must be very intimate and I must do them in person. So Corey and I are about 3 inches from each other right now.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
It's going to be a special one, Brian.
Sharing all a right. microphone.
Yes,
I feel left out. I feel left out.
You're the one that lives in Virginia.
That's true. It's my own bad.
It's true. We are going to get into some draft stuff. We're going to talk. We did our mailbag show last week. We're going to do an offensive prospect show this week with Josh. We're going to do a defensive prospect show next week. Then we have maybe a special show coming up after that. And then it's draft week, and we'll get into maybe old friend of the show, Tony Pauline, will come on.
Hey.
But before we do that, just a quick programming note for those Jets fans out here and SNY fans. Jets Nation is back on SNY this Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern time. It's an all-new episode with Janae Coakley, Eric Coleman, and Chad Cascannon. The crew will break down the addition of Matt Forte from the Bears and discuss whether or not the Jets should trade Muhammad Wilkerson. Make sure you check it out this Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on SNY. So again, Jets Nation is back on SNY this Sunday at 7. Make sure you guys check it out. There may even be a special mention of the Jets Blog Podcast on there if you happen to tune in. So if you see that, take a screenshot, send it to me and Brian on Twitter at Brian_Bassett at Corey Griffin NBC. But enough about that. Let's get into the show. Josh, I guess since we're sitting next to each other, I'll start with the first question. How does this group of offensive prospects compare to years past?
Okay. So off the bat, I have to be honest and say I am not the best at looking back. And that's not some life advice that I'm giving in terms of me not growing from past experiences.
Right.
But just in terms of this group of skill position players, I think that this is kind of the start of the running back revolution that is going to happen this year and next year. I think obviously Ezekiel Elliott's a great prospect, but even after that, I mean, Derrick Henry's super intriguing. I'm sure we'll get into these running backs a little bit, even though you guys have 20 of them. But Derrick Henry's a completely unique prospect, and I love when that happens because it's boom or bust and we get to see how that future plays out. But then after that, you have some three down players and three down running backs, ball carriers as well. And then this receiver class, people have been really critical of it, but I've gone on record numerous times over the last few months and say that there are a handful of quality pieces to offenses. You might not have your stars. You might not have your Odell Beckhams, your Sammy Watkins, your Mike Evans, so on and so forth, but you have some quality pieces to a passing game. And I think that's really all you can ask for during the early portions of a prospect's career at receiver. But then we'll quickly go to quarterback and say that last year I was in the heat of the quarterback debate with Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston. That's very far from the case this year. I would not spend a first-round pick in either one of these quarterbacks.
Well, that's interesting. We'll certainly get there. So you mentioned the wide receivers. We'll start there and we'll work our way inside, I guess, although we'll probably make some zigs and zags. There are a few generally considered first-round wide receivers, Corey Coleman, Josh Doctson, Michael Thomas from Ohio State, Laquon Treadwell. How do you see those shaking out? Is there anyone that I missed? Are there any of those four that you don't think is a first-round wide receiver?
Well, I had seen that Jeremiah said yesterday, right? Yeah, something about, was it Boyd? Who's the guy he was saying?
No, Will Fuller.
Will Fuller, thank
you. Will Fuller could be the number one receiver if what he is hearing is correct, which is shocking. That is surprising. But I think with this class, you have kind of a full tier. You have a grouping. And so in that case, an argument could be made for any of the receivers to be the number one type or number one prospect on the team's board at the position. Look, a receiver is not a receiver is not a receiver, right? Like, this isn't Madden where you can plug and play and it doesn't matter what they do. Every receiver in this draft does something differently very well. They win in different ways. Corey Coleman to me is the number one receiver in this class, but that's because I have a bias for prospects with big play ability. I mean, Corey Coleman is the best big play threat in this draft, no matter what position you're talking about. The way he can run after the catch with screens at the line of scrimmage, or test the field vertically down the field, on those nine routes, on those deeper portions, 20 plus yards. To me, it really stands out. And look, people are going to have their issues with Corey Coleman. He had drops. He didn't run a full route tree. He's under 6 feet tall. Again, I completely understand those. But Corey Coleman, to me, is a true game breaker. And outside of turnovers, big plays change the scope and the outcome of a contest. And quickly, I'll just go to a couple others. Laquon Treadwell, like, is the complete opposite, honestly. Like, you have a 4.63 receiver who's in the bottom 30th percentile in terms of athleticism at the position, who's 6'2", 215 pounds, who's a possession receiver, and possession receiver kind of has a negative connotation to it. And it really shouldn't. I mean, he's the type of possession receiver that team should want. Josh Doctson's a bit older. I think he's 24. That might have played into a factor as to why he was so dominant at college level. But if you want someone that can go up and get it at the catch point in this contested situations, that's absolutely Josh Doctson. And he's as good of an athlete as Corey Coleman is, honestly, which is surprising. And finally, Michael Thomas. My buddy Dane Brugler has posted at some point during the process that potentially one reason that Michael Thomas redshirted for a year was because he couldn't pick up the playbook. And no one's really talking about that. And that's not something I'm going to stress because I don't know the guy, you know. But on the field, Michael Thomas reminds me a lot of Michael Crabtree, which is a comparison Rumford Johnny has made in the past. And it makes a ton of sense. Yards after catch, he's sneaky athletic. He really is. He can build up speed very quickly and explosively without being quick, if that makes sense. I would say that those are the top four in this class.
You know, it's interesting because I had seen a comparison. I was curious to see what you thought of this. Someone was trying to come up with a comparison for Treadwell. And, you know, I don't expect that the Jets would necessarily take Treadwell, but they said Michael Crabtree. What do you think about that? Is that a good comparison comparison?
It seems like every year we compare these receivers to the same prospects. And it's the same thing at the quarterback spot. Like every year there's one Ben Roethlisberger, you know what I mean? Or for running back, he's the best since Adrian Peterson, so on and so forth. And I think Michael Crabtree is kind of one of those types. I don't see Laquon Treadwell and Michael Crabtree as the similar players, because I think Michael Crabtree is a very underrated player in terms of his yards after catch capabilities, especially when he was with the 49ers. And that's part of these comparisons that can be tricky, right? It's like, at what point are you comparing a player to another player? Is it when he came into the NFL? Was it with his first team? Because Michael Crabtree with Oakland and Michael Crabtree with San Francisco, kind of different players.
And the Michael Crabtree at Texas Tech is a different player.
Correct.
Yeah, he was dynamic. I thought he was an electric player when he was at Texas Tech. Correct. And when he came in the league, I was just kind of like, meh.
With the 49ers, Crabtree was – there was one season he was like a top three or four player after the catch. And I'm not sure if we see that anymore, but that's what happens.
Yeah, no, he's kind of he's evolved into a Bolden type possession guy who doesn't have the best speed, isn't going to beat you over the top, but has the nuances down.
And I would say that that Treadwell is a possession receiver, and he's not going to break off 10 plus yard runs after the catch, but he is super powerful and super strong before and after the catch. And that's how he creates a separation, using his size, using that strength. And then after the catch, he can pick up those extra 3 or 4 yards consistently. And those 3 or 4 yards really add up. Absolutely.
Okay. So look, the past few years, I think, and understandably so, the wide receivers have gotten caught up in these first round hype. You know, now we've had a couple years of stellar wide receiver prospects. But the best receiver in the NFL right now was a 6th round pick.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying who's the next Antonio Brown. I'm not asking for tell me who the 6th round pick is that the Jets should draft or any of that. But if the Jets go wide receiver, it's probably not going to be at 20. It's probably not going to be in the 2nd round. It's probably not even going to be in the 3rd round. So is there a value to receiver in the later rounds, or is it a top heavy class?
Well, and it's all about type and how you use them. I mean, no matter what, stars that come out of the later portions of the draft, I mean, they went later because they were difficult projections in some ways. I mean, I don't remember, but I can look back Antonio Brown just didn't test like the player that he is. And that played a factor. I mean, a sub 6 foot receiver that ran the 4.6s, I think it was, or the late 4.5s, that plays a factor. I mean, maybe it shouldn't because we look at overall athleticism, but it does play a factor. I mean, there are definitely certain types. Like, if you want purely a slot receiver that is very good in the short to intermediate game that can create separation with burst and explosion and change of direction, the Western Michigan wide receiver Daniel Braverman is like a really interesting prospect. Mm. Now, do I expect – he wasn't even invited to the combine. He was an early entry.
That's never good. That's never good, right?
And if you look back on the success rate of wide receivers that were not invited to the combine, it's super low. Like, there's only one or two that have had even decent NFL careers. And I know that the whole media circus loves Daniel Braverman, and they love Michael Thomas from Southern Miss. But again – if you're just looking at not the prospect, but what it looks like in the past for them in terms of their draft narrative and their draft storyline and where it's going, not going to combine, you're betting against the odds here, which is fine. I mean, it works sometimes, but you're kind of taking a leap of faith in that regard.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, the other thing here is that the Jets certainly seem to be coming into a type, and then we'll flip it over to running backs in a minute, but they seem to be giving a type, and Devin Thomas seems to be at the, I would say, at the low end of that type, right? They want a guy who's 6 foot, you know, a little bit, you know, could, you know, obviously he has a different role than Onunwa and Marshall and Decker, but they seem to like the guys who are bigger than 6 feet. But you think about Brandon Marshall, think about Eric Decker, think about Quincy Onunwa, think about Devin Thomas. What are they missing? Like, other than a returner, like a punter, kick returner, what are they missing in that group?
Interesting. Like, Devin Smith is fascinating. And I think he could be a really intriguing piece for you guys, because everyone's kind of, I mean, there have been some comparisons between Devin Smith and Will Fuller in this draft, who you brought up earlier. Mm-hmm. But to me, there's a glaring difference, and that's that Devin Smith is an outstanding receiver at going up and winning those contested catches. Like, vertical receivers, we always talk about speed first and foremost, but really it's ball skills, and it's being able to high point a pass or make a catch that the defensive back cannot defend against. And I think Devin Smith does that extremely well, and Will Fuller doesn't. Now, Will Fuller has easy speed, and he can get down the field, but I think there's a stark difference between the two. What are they missing? I mean, I think Brandon Marshall's obviously an outstanding receiver. Eric Decker's a very solid receiver, especially in the red zone. I mean, you guys, I guess, let go Jeremy Curley? And yeah. Do you really – like, what type of receiver – because, I mean, I'm not – you know, professional with the Jets.
Sure.
Like, I don't closely follow them, honestly. I just hear Corey complain about them every single week. So what type of, I mean, is it a slot receiver that you guys need?
Well, the way I look at it is they're in a weird spot. And I know we spent a lot of time on a position that they're probably not going to address in this draft.
Not until late, yeah.
But what's interesting to me is they're a year away from having to address it. So I could see them addressing it a year early if they wanted to, unless they truly believe in Onunwa and Smith as the future of the position. Because look, Eric Decker and Brandon Marshall are great. They're very good at what they each do. But Brandon Marshall had a career season at age 32. That's probably not going to repeat itself for the next 2 years. And they're both entering their second to last year of their contract. So at this time next year, they're both being the last year. And we all know how receivers like entering the last year of their contracts. They don't. So I think it's a situation where, much like running back, and we can kind of transition this way.
I would even transition to tight end.
Well, okay, so
that's good.
They have Onunwa, who's their H-back.
Okay.
They have, if we want to talk tight end, they have Amaro, who.
But do they? Hands.
Well, he's on the roster. He's technically on the roster. He will be in camp in a jersey this summer.
For how long?
Well, let's spin this back. Okay, so go finish your point.
Well, we can move on to tight end.
I think Jace Amaro unlocks this thing for me, right? I don't know about you, Josh, but when I look at this tight end class, this 2016 tight end class, I think it's worse than last year's tight end class, and I hated last year's tight end class. So I'm curious what you think of the tight ends in this group. Yeah. Is there anybody that you're like, man, I'm excited to see this guy play, or, you know, maybe here's a guy in the fifth round who could be a value. But, you know, that second, third round, you're kind of wasting a draft pick to use it. What do you think?
Well, I think tight end prospects in general just suck. Like,
that's true.
It probably more than any other position, they struggle to transition from college to the NFL. And that's partially for what the tight end position now is in college. I mean, you rarely see a tight end contribute early on in his career. I mean, the breakout tight end last year was Gary Barnidge, who was on his obviously second
or whatever.
And almost at the end of his contract on the second team.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm someone that follows the Panthers every single week. And it was always this year's Gary Barnidge, this year it's Gary Barnidge. And it never happened until obviously now with the Cleveland Browns. Yeah, I mean, I would say that this tight end class is interesting. I wouldn't be surprised if the run on tight end started in the second round or if it started in the third round or the early part of the fourth round. Everyone's talking about Hunter Henry, who was used from a variety of different alignments. I would say he's like a less athletic version of Greg Olsen, which Greg Olsen's a very good prospect, but people forget he ran like a 4.56 and had a very good athletic testing coming out of college. But the thing with Hunter Henry is that he's already like a willing blocker, but he sucks at it. Like he's not good at it. So in order to stay on the field, you have to be at least willing and adequate. I think he shows the willingness, but he's just not good. So he might just be a package player. And that's a big difference between someone that's a three down player and maybe like a Gavin Escobar. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
But if you guys want like a fourth or fifth round player who I think is not receiving nearly enough attention, and he's purely a receiving threat, but it's Cal Steven Anderson. He played basically wide receiver for them, a lot of slot receiver. But he's 230 pounds, I think about 6'2 or 6'3, and he's awesome. I mean, if you want someone to dominate the short to intermediate levels of the game, and you mentioned size at the receiver position. So you can go small with your slot receiver, or you can go big with your slot receiver, right? And I think Steven Anderson is the type for a team. I know you have an H-back already. I would just guess that Steven Anderson's a better prospect, in my opinion, than I thought Quincy Enunwa was coming out of college. He can be that short to intermediate type that can be used in all different alignments, all different motions. And I think someone's going to get a steal with him in the fourth or the fifth round.
Okay, so we've talked about wide receiver and we've talked about tight end. And we've kind of not danced around it, but we haven't talked about the two main issues. And we'll come back to running back if we have time at the end. But I want to talk about the two big positions that the Jets need the most help. We'll save quarterback for the last. We'll start with offensive line. At number 20, I've seen Decker mocked to the Jets. I think you mocked him to the Jets.
Yep.
I saw yesterday or this week Mel Kiper mocked the guy who I am never going to pronounce his
Jermaine
name.
Jermaine Ifedi.
There you go. From Texas A&M.
Nice.
To the Jets at 20. I know a lot of people think that's a reach. What tackles the Jets, and this comes on the heels of the Jets reportedly asking to bring Shel Ferguson to take a pay cut. I don't think those two things are coincidences.
And also, like, there's obviously some just to clue you in a little bit, Josh, there's some strain between DeBrickshaw and the front office, as has been reported. Who knows how strained it actually is. Right tackle Bruno Giacomini is a train wreck. And then, you know, they also have a guard
type,
position.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. He's great after the whistle. He's fantastic after the whistle.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Unfortunately, they've gained yards between the whistles, so that's probably kind of a problem. All right, so the Jets need at least one tackle. They probably need a guard.
Maybe a center long-term for Nick Mangold as well.
They probably need a developmental. Now, that might be something where they look to an undrafted player or a seventh-round or sixth-round prospect. But let's start at tackle. Who are the tackle prospects that we should expect to be there at 20?
So – obviously, Lamry Tunsil is going to be off the board, so I'm not even going to discuss him. You know what? I think there's an outside chance that Ronnie Stanley's still on the board. Because I blurb all these anonymous scouts, all these random evaluators, right? And there's been some negative buzz on Ronnie Stanley. And I guess I understand it because with these offensive tackle prospects, people evaluate off a checklist. And, like, Ronnie Stanley's not the most powerful offensive lineman. Like, he uses his length and his feet and his frame and his positioning as his anchor.
Sounds like Shaw Ferguson to me.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
Right. And I mean, Ronnie Stanley had a great performance against Shaq Lawson this year. Shaq Lawson won a few snaps, but all your offensive linemen are going to lose at some point during the game. It just depends on the situation, on how impactful it is on the game. And I absolutely love Ronnie Stanley. I've been talking about him for 2 years. I think he's a top 15 prospect in this draft. And I think people are kind of just trying to find negatives here or letting the negatives cloud their judgment. I think Taylor Decker will likely still be on the board, but that's kind of like a fringe thing here. But he's a very different prospect than Ronnie Stanley. And we know that all these offensive line coaches have their types and their prototypes at the positions. So I'm not one to say that, well, this is the one that the Jets want, but Taylor Decker, like how Stanley plays away from his body using his length, Taylor Decker wants to fight you in a phone booth. He wants to fight you near his body. And he's another one of those maulers, those powerful players. I mean, the play that Jalen Smith got injured on, it was a push after the whistle. Not saying that was a bad thing, but it's because Taylor Decker loves to get the second level and push people to the ground. There's two other guys that have been mentioned, Jack Conklin and Jermaine Defetti. I think both those guys are not good, honestly, in terms of first-round prospects. Jack Conklin, his footwork is an absolute mess. Like, crosses over his feet, doesn't do a good pass set. People say he's athletic. Yeah, I mean, he's an average NFL athlete, which doesn't mean he's a bad NFL athlete. He's an average one. So that athleticism, it's not the type of like a Jason Spriggs from Indiana, which is another possibility. And Jermaine Ifedi, I mean, this is someone that couldn't even like lock down the left tackle spot at Texas A&M long term. And I think if you want to go back and find the issues with Jermaine Ifedi, look at his Arkansas game during the 2014 season. And those Arkansas edge rushers aren't outstanding. Like, they can be NFL players, Trey Flowers in the NFL, so on and so forth. But he just could not handle power at all. He's another one of these guys with footwork and length, and that works in college. But I just don't think how he succeeded in college will work in the NFL. I mean, I wouldn't take Jermaine Ifedi in the top two rounds, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Was he like one of these kind of like Vlad Dukas late to the game types? I really don't know too much about Ifedi yet.
I can't answer that. I mean, okay. I know that he was like the fourth in the pipeline of the Mike Sherman offensive linemen. I mean, it was okay. Luke Jokel, Jake Matthews, Cedric Ogboihe, and Jermaine Ifedi. And I think Ifedi played some guard along with Ogboihe, and then they moved him to tackle because that's what they always do in that line. But I think he's easily the worst of the four.
Of those four.
And then you have someone like
Luke Jokel's in that group. So right.
And then you have like someone like the Raven Clark at Texas Tech, who played in like an air raid offense, where honestly, you have to completely throw out his tape because it doesn't matter. It's all up to your offensive line coach. And I would say more than any other position, offensive line coaches probably have more of an impact on who that team drafts. Obviously, each club is going to be different, but because they want a certain temperament, they want a certain style, they want a certain tape, they want them to block in a certain way. And I would say LaRaven Clark is only going to be drafted on a team if a coach stands on the table for him, if a position coach stands on the table for him and says, hey, we're going to draft this guy.
Okay. Mm. All right.
So that's interesting. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was going to say it's hard. I'm not in the room. So we've talked about tackle, talked about some, you know, guys maybe in the middle or late part there. You're talking about offensive coaches and, you know, offensive line coaches. And so I'm curious. So the Jets kind of run, I guess, what would you call it, Corey? Like a zone?
It's a zone scheme. It's a Chan Gailey zone scheme.
Okay. Yeah. So if that's their kind of type, and I know they're not going to pick a guard in the first round. There's no Brandon Scherff or, you know, those kind of types. It doesn't seem to me in this class. Who should the Jets and Jets fans be looking at in the second, third, fourth round at the guard position?
Absolutely. Joe Thuney, who's a guard from NC State. He played tackle as well and even has practiced at center. No one's talking about Joe Thuney. And I think Joe Thuney, I think I have him like right inside of the top 50, maybe 55, something like that. One, he's one of the top athletes at the position, but two, those movement skills come into play. Like in that system, I'm guessing other than Bruno Giacomini, you don't need someone that can move people off the ball. It's kind of an occupier, a positional block, get in someone's way, slant blocks, getting to the second level, all those things. Joe Thuney's outstanding in that area. This is someone, again, who I think is almost a top 50 prospect in this draft, if not a top 50, and just not receiving the same amount of attention. I'll add this, though. For everyone that talks about how great this defensive line class is, the center class is right behind it. The center class is outstanding. And it starts with Ryan Kelly, who might play some guard in the NFL from Alabama, an outstanding prospect, a top 20 prospect in this draft. But then you go beyond there, and center is the type of position you guys won't know. I mean, might not know this because you've had Nick Mangold for forever. Mm-hmm. But centers, even if they're drafting the sixth or seventh or undrafted, play early on in their careers with a bunch of other teams. And that's going to be the case this year. I bet you every single center that was at the Senior Bowl will start at some point during their rookie contract because it's that good of a class.
That's interesting. Wow. That's interesting. All right. Speaking of interesting, let's get to the big finale, which might be an oxymoron considering this year's class of quarterbacks. The two big ones, Jared Goff and Carson Wentz, hand size apart, Josh. And I know that's a tough thing to put aside. But hand size, hairstyle, pro days aside, what is the difference between these two quarterbacks?
Well, I'm not going to give you a lot of optimism here with these quarterbacks. Like, I love the two last year, Marcus Mariota, Jameis Winston. But the difference with these this year is that they all have fatal flaws, but they're all different types of fatal flaws,
yeah.
Right? And I think when looking back in recent years at quarterbacks that have failed since 2011, it's because teams and media evaluators alike believe that the fatal flaws those prospects had were correctable. And they just weren't. I mean, you look back at EJ Manuel and Christian Ponder. They were just bad in college. Like, they were average in college, right? You look at Jake Locker. The completion percentage was horrendous. You look at Blaine Gabbert. He saw ghosts in the pocket and just left immediately. Hey, Paxton Lynch, what's up? You look at Johnny Manziel. I mean, Johnny Manziel was a complete unique evaluation that there was no mirror image of. And so how could you project success if there wasn't already someone succeeding like him in the NFL? And so on and so on, you know? And with these two, I would say that Carson Wentz's fatal flaw is that he stares at the primary receiver far too often. He freezes and presses pause in the pocket. And that's a huge issue because at the college level, those were completions, right? He just stopped his feet, stopped his eyes, stopped his shoulders, waited for that primary receiver to beat his man in coverage, and then throw him the ball without throwing with anticipation. So those completions will turn into incompletions or maybe even pick sixes in the NFL, if we're being honest. And then just over to Jared Goff quickly. And I know that his offense coordinator has been taking like this media circus and saying like, well, he had more to do pre-snap than anyone in the NFL. That's BS. Like, get out of here. You're just talking up your system and you're talking up your guy. That's ridiculous. So last offseason, I watched a coaching clinic that Sonny Dykes, the head coach at Cal, gave. And he talked about his Texas Tech days. And I'm not saying that the air raid offense at Cal is the same one at Texas Tech. They call it the bear raid. Woo! Anyways.
That's awesome.
And Dykes talked about how they only had 5 to 7 passing concepts. And when they added one, they had to get rid of one. And so, yes, wow. Jared Goff absolutely mastered those 5 to 7, right? He knew where to go if that primary receiver was not there. But I think that if you just go to the NFL, and I'm all for simplistic offenses in the NFL and just using different personnel and different alignments, those types of things. But I think the jump that he has to take from college to the NFL is a very big one in that department because it's processing. And you see him freak out when he has to process things that he's not expecting. He can drift away from the pocket. He can freeze at times. And that's a major issue, in my opinion.
That's concerning. Brian, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, the two guys that were so interesting to me, you know, a year ago, you know, were Connor Cook and Christian Hackenberg, and saying, you know, maybe these guys will be, you know, top of the first round guys next year. Obviously, Hackenberg's decline has, you know, just kind of continued as he's gotten farther away from the Bill O'Brien scheme.
Yeah.
And Connor Cook was a guy that I think, you know, in January of last year, people said this guy could edge out, you know, maybe a Jameis Winston or a Marcus Mariota for the second quarterback in this class. What's happened to those guys? Or did we just misread them a year ago to where we are now?
I think there's always some misreading there with quarterbacks, especially with crowning them early. Like, Hackenberg was crowned far too early. I'll say this. I think both are probably second or third round prospects. I mean, selections. Mm-hmm. Let's not call them evaluations that way, but selections. First, Christian Hackenberg. One, I think people crowned him too early, that his freshman year wasn't as good as people made it out to be. I think things were much more defined around him, and it worked out. But in the last 2 years, like, there have just been more excuses for him than any other player I've ever covered. Like, oh, the offensive line was bad. The coaching was bad. Sometimes the skill position players let him down. Sure, yeah. But even when all those facets of the game went well, he still played poorly, right? And we have seen prospects with terrible situations around them elevate the talent around them and play well. I mean, Marcus Mariota, his final year at Oregon, like, they were starting a walk-on and, like, a true freshman at tackle. He was getting hit after hit after hit, and he still played well, you know? Mm-hmm. And we just do not see that from Christian Hackenberg at all. But apparently he's fills all the buzzwords and might go in the second round. Anyways, flipping over to Connor Cook, and this isn't going to be, an optimistic one, but I think he can be an okay quarterback in the NFL if the interior of the pocket is clean. So maybe not for the Jets.
is that some sort of dig at the Jets guard play?
Well, I think it's a
Brian Winters?
I've got an idea. The Jets take all their defensive linemen and play them Iron Men, so they play them as offensive linemen too, and then we'll be good. Well, right?
Is Rex coming back? Because didn't he draft some defensive linemen moving to offensive line?
Probably. Yeah.
Well, he moved
the Michigan guy.
Yes,
what's his name?
Yes. Oh, well, we could just hire Tom Cable if we wanted to do that.
There you go. But anyways, Connor Cook. Like, if the interior pocket is clean, like, he makes some outstanding throws. Like, he's one of the best back shoulder sideline throwers that I've seen at the college level. And he didn't just do it with one receiver. He did it with both Tony Lippett and Aaron Burbridge. And he makes some really ridiculous throws into tight windows. Then there are other times where, you know, it's that he makes some very poor decisions. Just some very poor decisions. And he can be very erratic with his throwing style. And that's an issue. And falling away from passes in the interior is a major issue. That can be a major fatal flaw, and he shows that tendency far too often.
Okay. Last question here before we let you go. I'm going to skip Paxton Lynch. I have a pretty good idea what you think of him.
Mm-hmm.
I think your crack earlier has a pretty good idea of what you think of him. We can talk about him more on a later podcast. But I want to talk to you about a very late-round prospect who I'm very excited about and interested in. It's Vernon Adams.
Yeah!
I didn't watch a ton of college football as much as you did.
Right.
But I watch enough. And is it? Am I wrong in thinking that I am more excited by watching the limited amount of Vernon Adams that I saw than everything that I saw from Bryce Petty?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. So here's the thing. And I'll throw some Paxton Lynch in here. Like, everyone loves to talk about Paxton Lynch and he's big and he's mobile and he has an arm and all that kind of stuff. But what Paxton Lynch did in college does not translate to the NFL because it was a rock step catch and release offense where after that first read is not there, he maybe looks at a second and then he leaves the pocket, right? So there's no poise, there's no patience inside of a confined space. It depends on what games you watched of Vernon Adams, because when they were on the national landscape early on in the season, he played with a broken index finger on his throwing hand and did not play well at all. Then took like a game or two off, came back and healed. And Oregon like was barely even ranked, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't playing well. And he came in and played outstanding. But no one knew because no one was watching. West Coast, late times, not ranked.
Pac-12 Network.
Right. But Vernon Adams, what he does translates far more than a guy like Paxton Lynch, far more than a guy like Bryce Petty. Like, he had to win inside the pocket almost every single snap. But it's crazy because last year we had the same storyline with Marcus Mariota that he did not win in the pocket. Hey, guys, he did. And he did his rookie year when they made him a pocket. But same thing with Vernon Adams. He can be an extension of what the offensive coordinator wants him to run on the field. But then what he also offers is this improvisational style. It's winning outside of structure. It's buying time, either stepping up in the pocket or escaping out the back door. And always keeping his eyes up. Keeping your eyes up in the face of a pass rush is really critical. And I understand that Vernon Adams is 5'10 or 5'11 or whatever it is. And I understand that he's not going to get drafted in the top four rounds, maybe even five rounds. But to me, if he gets a chance, a la Tyrod Taylor in a few years, I think you could see Vernon Adams being a starter in the NFL. He's a top five quarterback prospect to me. And I'm really intrigued to see his projection and how his he transitions to the NFL and if he's given a shot. And I think that's sometimes the most important part with these unique prospects.
Okay. So
curious, just quickly to wrap, how do you beat Chip Kelly? Like, what round do you have to take of Vernon Adams to beat Chip Kelly to that guy? I'm just curious. Well,
no. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think people kind of say that with Chip, the most important part of his offense is the mobility. And I would say we've seen in the past that it's recognizing the open receiver and getting it to them in a timely manner. But I will say about Chip that I do think his final year in Philly, it showed that if his quarterback is not mobile at all, it really hinders the running attack.
He's no threat.
Right. And I recently did a draft needs thing with Evan Silva, and I mocked Vernon Adams to the Jets, I think in round five or something like that, mm-hmm. round six. And I kind of reverted me back to the Tyler Thigpen era in the Chan Gailey offense. Because Tyler Thigpen was athletic, and he could go vertically down the field. And Vernon Adams can do the exact same things. Now, I have no clue if Chan Gailey likes Vernon Adams, but I think the styles can really, really match up.
All right. Well, that's now I have something to watch on day three. Josh, we very much appreciate your time. I appreciate you sitting very close to me and managing to make it through this entire thing with a straight face, mind you.
Yes, we barely made eye contact, though.
It's true. It's true.
While holding hands, though. So that's nice.
It was a little awkward, but I feel like our relationship has grown deeper. Josh, you can find you on Twitter at Josh Norris. Read your stuff on rotoworld.com. You've got some really spiffy graphics on Twitter these days. I wonder who's doing that for you. You can also see Josh on PFT, on Pro Football Talk, and all across the RSN networks, CSN Philly, CSN Bay Area, all those fun places. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Brian, thank you for joining us. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian_Bassett. I am at Corey Griffin NBC. Until next time, folks, keep calm and jet on.
Give me a lineman.
This has been the Jets Blog Podcast, part of the SNY.TV Audio Network.